This episode contains offensive and potentially harmful language that refers to Black communities in Canada. Some of the stories that are shared also include vivid descriptions of physical and verbal violence that may be difficult for some listeners to hear. Discover Library and Archives Canada presents Porter Talk. This production explores the lived experiences of Black men who labored as sleeping car porters for both the Canadian National and Canadian Pacific Railways during the 20th century. Their voices, along with those of their wives and children, relay stories of both hardship and resilience. This is the first season of Voices Revealed, a series that amplifies the voices of underrepresented and marginalized communities held within Library and Archives Canada's vast oral history holdings. Narratives of injustice, conflict, persistence, and resolution enable us to understand how the past powerfully defines our present. They also provide compelling insights that push us to imagine new directions for our collective future. My name is Richard Provencher, and as your host of the first season of Voices Revealed, I am pleased to guide you through the stories that are at the heart of Porter Talk.
What did you think of the practice of tipping?
What did I think of the practice?
Did it offend you in any way? Did you like receiving tips? Or
oh, I wouldn't say it was offensive, but sometimes you went over backwards and did little extras. So naturally, it was an encouragement in order to do good.
What did you think of the practice of tipping?
It was degrading to a certain extent. We went into the field knowing that was part of what to expect. So the average person did not consider the degrading part of that attitude, because you know, you were, a lot of us took that porter's job just through necessity. I don't like cleaning my own shoes. I pay to clean my own shoes. But I had to clean other people's shoes so as to be able to make a decent living and to maintain my family. Because there wasn't any opportunity open to me in those days. I came here with my degrees and I couldn't get a decent job. So I had to go and where I could make a few dollars and maintain the standard of living that I was accustomed to. From home.
Next question is, what do you think of the practice of tipping?
The practice of tipping is very demeaning. It's part of slavery.
Our pay was not that good that we could go around and say, I don't accept tips. Because tips, at the time, in the early days, was a good part of my earnings. I needed those tips. Whatever it was.
Your attitude towards tipping? The porter receiving tips from the passenger. Did you have any feeling for or against the practice of tipping?
Well, as far as tipping concerned, we had no alternative because that was part of our wages. Especially before we were organized, if we hadn't had tips, we couldn't have survived. We had to have tips because. It made us, it took a lot of dignity out of our thinking and our ways. We had to be a little more humble in order to succumb to passes, in order to get these tips, in order to survive.
We used to make more off of tips in those days than we did in wages, because the wages is very low. And we'd make a pretty good, a round trip, we could make a pretty good living off it. In fact, a lot of the guys bought their houses and their cars and put their sons and daughters through college through this railroad. A lot of the office staff wonder how they did it, but they did it and kept their kids dressed well, fed, and become pretty good citizens.
Until the mid-20th century, portering was one of the few employment opportunities available to Black men outside of their communities in Canada. While it offered job security, wages were purposely low. The work echoed models of servitude dominant during antebellum slavery. Sleeping car porters, in particular, were part of a fantasy that allowed white customers to imagine themselves in an era when black labor was extractive and inhumane. A heavy reliance on tips further dehumanized the men, reinforcing unequal power dynamics. But as Dr. Sage Mathieu, associate professor of history at the University of Minnesota, and author of North of the Color Line, Migration and Black Resistance in Canada, 1870 to 1955, asks, what other options did they have?
African Americans and West Indians and Canadian-born black folk who found their way to the rails learned how to stretch a dime into a dollar, how to squeeze, you know, I forget who I heard recently say, like, you know, if someone brings lemons, gives you lemons, like find someone with tequila. And that's pretty much what they did. And so, you know, these were never living wages. These were never, this wasn't even assured work. But against the background of other available work to black folks, this was worth the fight. What are the alternatives? Agricultural work, cotton farming, sugarcane farming in the Caribbean. I mean, meat packing, back-breaking work that are long hours in harsh conditions, and to be clear, where you could easily get killed, right? And so if you could get on the rails, it was worth finding a way to hold on to that work.
Refusals to adequately compensate the men for their service went hand in hand with the exploitative duties of which they were tasked. This reality was made possible because of the anti-black racism that held our society together and the discriminatory institutional culture that was central to the operation of Canadian railways. Settle in as Melvin Crump, a porter who worked out of the CPRO's Calgary division for 18 years, takes us through a typical day on the rails. Here he explains what it meant to offer luxury service aboard the Hotel on Wheels.
Well, the conditions under which we had to work, I had never been through this type of a condition on a job in all the days of my life. We had to, more or less, we were put under somewhat of a very strenuous obligation to hold your job on the CPR, meaning that, as an example, that when you got finished making down your beds during the night for your passengers to retire, and you had somewhat of 27 beds to make down, you had to go to work now and shine each and every of one of your passengers that had shoes to shine. You had to shine all these shoes up. And then after this, you cleaned up your washrooms, both at the men's end and at the women's end. You taken all the soiled towels and you bagged them and put them away. And you put out, after cleaning your sinks, etc., you then put out clean towels and soap for the next morning for your customers. Now, you're not finished yet, and this now must be somewhere around 1 o'clock in the morning. And you're getting awfully tired because you started at 7 o'clock in the morning, previous morning. Now you're getting awfully tired and you're not allowed to go to bed until such time, or lie down to have a rest until such time that your time period came up. And with some of us, our time period came up at 12, some came up at 1. But if your time was to go down at 12 o'clock to have a rest, you had to be up again in about 2.5 hours sleep so that you would be back on watch again. Now the watch, everybody's sleeping but you. And so you had to watch to see that nobody got up during the night or to cause any disturbance among the passengers that were sleeping or anyone from the other cars that's coming through that would cause any disturbance. It was your job to see that this didn't happen. Even if you were practically asleep on your feet walking through your car, checking and testing, you were half asleep doing this, but there was not too much that you could do about that because that was part of your duties and part of your job.
Dr. Mathieu adds another responsibility to the list of tasks laid out by Mr. Crump.
This is hard for people to imagine, but people literally would just buy a ticket for like their five-year-old and entrust them on an eight-hour train to get to grandma in Calgary. And, you know, they got on, I don't know, somewhere in Saskatchewan, and it was the porter's job. Imagine, right? They can't discipline these children. These children may be scared. They would probably be scared. They could be excited. And like he... he had to help like little girls go to the bathroom, like the minefield, right? And it's not your job.
But childcare and caregiving, especially for elderly or inebriated passengers, were implicit parts of their job. Roy Williams, who devoted 30 years of his life to portering and, like Mr. Crump, ran out of the CPR's Calgary division, explains the demands placed on porters succinctly.
Well, he had to be a jack, most likely a jack of all trades, looking at the...
And of course, as he notes, the days were never ending.
Well, the hours wasn't counted. We just worked, that's all. It was, the 24-hour day was... when we were on duty, why we could be called on any hour. There was no time limit. It was a full-time day.
As you can imagine, these long days took their toll on porters. Sleep deprivation was fundamental to the oppressive labor practices instituted by Canadian Railways at this time. Listen as Eddie Green recounts his first highly disorienting cross-country trip to an interviewer named Kay. This is a woman about whom we know little, but whose conversations with porters are also part of Stanley G. Grizzell's collection at Library and Archives Canada.
What we didn't get most of all was enough sleep, because they give you 3 hours sleep during the day, and you ran from, like, Montreal, Toronto to Vancouver. And the new men, that's the only jobs they could get, because the older fellows, they run local. So we'd... leave Toronto or Montreal and go 4 nights, 4 days on the road to Vancouver. And it was pretty rough. The first time I went to Vancouver, I thought I was in China by the time I got there.
Is that right?
Seems so long. I think I got to bed about 10 o'clock in the morning when I got in Vancouver. And I turned over at 10 o'clock at night, and I got up 10 o'clock the next day.
But and then would you come right back, or?
We had a day in Vancouver, then started back.
Mm. But was on the it was while you were on the road that you got very little sleep, is it?
Yes. Mm-hmm. You get your, they allotted you 3 hours out of the 24. Mm. And that was it. So when you got up, you're supposed to stay awake all day long and look after your people.
Did they not have a relief man? It was just one man to a car? No.
One man to a car, all the way.
Demerit points, or brownies as some refer to them, regulated porters' behavior on CPR trains. This system of punishment reprimanded the men for all kinds of offenses, fair or not. Anything from missing linens to complaints about service, perceived or real, to intoxication on the job to uniform violations counted, as did falling asleep. If a man attained 60 demerit points, then the company fired him. There was no appeal process. As a result, the men did anything they could to hold on to their jobs, trying their best to avoid being written up. In another conversation led by Kay, a former porter named Philip reveals the fine line he walked to avoid the merits, especially in regards to sleep.
I cheated a little. I kept one eye open and closed the other and tapped my foot.
Railway companies in Canada had little regard for the health and welfare of porters. They viewed black bodies as property that could be disposed of on a whim. There were always others standing by, willing to make the serious sacrifices this job demanded so as to have a chance at upward mobility. In addition to sleep deprivation, back injuries due to the manipulation of heavy berths and the carrying of large pieces of luggage, exposure to passengers' cigarette smoke and the heavy dust that poured in through the windows, burns from carrying hot food and drinks, confrontations with drunk and disorderly passengers, and train derailments contributed to the risks associated with this job. To make matters worse, there was often little downtime, usually less than 24 hours between runs. For those who worked for the CPR, the company put porters up in hotels, company-run boarding houses, or private homes. Raymond Coker tells us what hospitality looked like in some of these spaces.
We used to stay in private homes or some places the YMCA, and they left much to be desired. Believe me, the quarters in private homes were really bad, really bad. I had one bathroom, you know, maybe 15, 20 men there with one bathroom, so you know what that entails.
In addition to the physical risks associated with these extractive labor practices, deeply troubling encounters between porters and their passengers further exacerbated the difficulties black men faced on the rails. Harry Gary Sr. tells us about a confrontation he had with an elderly lady whose son had entrusted her care to him.
With me, and while I was on the job, money didn't mean a thing. I need money, but I put the human concept to work. And I take her in her room, we start off, and everything went well until we get to Kenora. That's about 10 o'clock the following night. Our next stop will be Winnipeg, so now it was in the morning at Kenora. She wanted me to send a telegram. She gave me the telegram at Fort William, and she gave me a $20 bill. I always take a note of, I call her attention to it, but she was old, says, there's $20, madam, okay. And I went out and sent a telegram, and the telegram was 65 cents. And brought back her change, $19. And 35 cents, I checked it out, $19.35. So when we got into Winnipeg, I went to the diner to get our breakfast because she couldn't leave our room. I got our breakfast, the waiter brought it back, ordered our breakfast. The waiter brought it back, taken to our room. Now apparently she couldn't find enough money. She couldn't find her money, she hid it away and probably she forget where she put it, you know. And so I take the empties, because the dining car were busy, I take the empties, dishes, up to the diner. And when I get up there, the steward says to me, he says, the lady accused you of stealing her money, says she had no money to pay for it. I said, what? I get real angry. I says, what? Oh, I was terribly upset.
It is unclear whether Mr. Gary faced a formal reprimand from his superior for this incident. There's a click in the audio file which suggests that the rest of the story continued to be told off the record. In any regard, this incident drives home the power white folks held over porters, the ease with which such accusations could be made, and the lasting harm these words could have on a man and his otherwise stellar reputation. But it is important to remember that porters were not always powerless in these types of situations. While risky, some, like Thomas Lawrence Williams, took it back when necessary, unwilling to sustain the abuse directed at them.
Another lady I had on there, she's from the state of Miss American Tourist. So she asked me to make her bed down, so I made her bed down. And while she going to the washroom, when she come back, she said I stole her watch. And I said, no, I haven't seen your watch. So we had a very nice Pullman conductor on this. We were running from Vancouver to Chicago at that time. And I went and got him. So he said to me, look at you, look at, I know this man, I know he hasn't took your watch. Oh yes, he did, I left right on the bed here. He said, look at me, let me look in your bag. She said, no, no. And he said, I'm gonna look in there anyway. And in your purse, if you don't open it, I will open it for you because I'll go get the train conductor. So he went and got the train conductor, they came back. And they opened her bag up and her watch is right there.
Talking back to a passenger, as Mr. Williams just did, was both daring and dangerous. Had the watch not been found, it is likely that he would have been fired for his behavior. While he refused to remain silent and take this abuse, it is important to point out that he drew on white men, the Pullman connector and the train conductor, for help. His ability to maintain power in this situation, particularly if the train was on American soil, was limited and could put him in physical peril. Much of the mob violence and lynchings that occurred there throughout the 20th century began with false accusations such as the one Mr. Williams describes. White witnesses who could be trusted were absolutely essential to escalating this incident and resolving it. Historians Michelle A. Johnson and Funke Aladejebi remind us of the importance of moving beyond the myth of benign whiteness that has been deeply implanted into our country's imaginary. While Canada never instituted Jim Crow laws, like those in the United States which enforced racial segregation, it is patently false to believe that our country has been a place of equity and racial and cultural tolerance. Porter's stories about life both on and off the rails, like this one shared by Oliver Charles Davis, reveal the deeply ingrained and often invisible nature of Canadian racism.
Tell me about the meals. I seem to recall it when we were away from home. I seem to recall being in Vancouver and having not being able to eat in the restaurant. I had to eat in the commissary. Do you recall that?
Oh, of course. My first experience was that would be in Calgary.
Yeah.
My first trip into Calgary, of course, never had been there before. We finally found the sign-out office, and we asked when we got through there where we could have breakfast, and we were told to go in to the basement and we'll find a kitchen down there where we can eat. And that's exactly what we had to do. It was, we were segregated.
All right.
And we couldn't eat in the restaurants upstairs on the, in the main restaurants in the CPR station in Calgary. Another experience was in Regina. You couldn't even, I can recall being refused a chance to eat in restaurants in Regina.
What did you eat in Regina?
Didn't eat. We, until the following morning.
Really?
That's a fact. My first trip into Regina, I'd been through Regina many, many times, of course, but Regina was not a stopping point, as you know, for any of our cars from the east. But in this particular trip, we'd gone to New York, and we had picked up troops in New York, and went from New York direct to Regina. And we got in there 10 o'clock at night. And of course porters wanted to have something to eat before we went to bed. Mm-hmm. There was no facilities there for us, no quarters for porters in Regina, so we would have to sleep on the cars. And when we went up into the town, we were told, just out of note, that you can't eat in here. We don't serve blacks here.
Finding a middle ground between both the perceptions and the realities that have long defined Canada has always been integral to the ways that black Canadians and black migrants have experienced this place. As Cheryl Fogo, an award-winning Canadian author, documentary film director, screenwriter, and playwright with a deep familial connection to portering notes, sometimes the devil you know is better than the one you don't.
Canada figured quite prominently in the narrative of the Promised Land, which was so prominent in our musical, in the canon of our music. And although Canada specifically wasn't named usually in those songs,
all those references to the promised land, some even to heaven, crossing the River Jordan, Canaan land, were connected to people's belief that there was safety further north and sometimes even specifically in Canada. And yet, they knew with every fiber of their being that they were not allowed in certain spaces and that they would face challenges and that when they were taking their crops to market, they were being cheated. They knew these things. And when it's explicit, as it was in the society that they had left behind, it's sometimes easier to figure out how to work around it than when it is unspoken.
It is important to point out that Black Canadians, like Mr. Davis, who experienced oppressive instances of segregation, did not face these injustices alone, as Cheryl Fogo explains.
There was solidarity between Black people and other racialized communities as well. Before Black people established their own restaurants in Calgary, they had tremendous community with Chinese people who had restaurants already, and they knew they could go there in safety and get a meal and not be prevented from coming in or not sit there and wait for service that never came. So that solidarity also existed between Black and Chinese people, Chinese immigrants, and also Sikh. Same thing. There were many people who intermarried with Sikh communities that were already here as well and have been here for generations. And I think a lot of people think of Black history as a binary between Black and white people, but we don't often get the opportunity to talk about the fact that there was a tremendous community and solidarity between different immigrant and racialized communities and Black people. And sometimes some of our best supports came from those interconnected relationships.
Resilience, as Cheryl Fogel continues, was also deeply rooted in the relationships that Black Canadians forged and have long sustained with Indigenous peoples.
In terms of Black and Indigenous solidarity, you know, it is a very complex relationship. And I almost never know how to answer that question when it comes to Black life on the prairies, because there is almost no Black family I can think of that doesn't have Indigenous members. There was so much intermarriage and friendship between Black and Indigenous people that it's almost like talking about, was there air that people breathed? There was a tremendous support and skills that were learned about how to survive in this place specifically. But it wasn't necessarily, you're over there and we're over here and we'll come over and show you this. It was, in some cases, true community that led to marriage. And those relationships are ongoing into our lives today.
In addition to interracial solidarity, the community that Porters built amongst themselves helped them move past the abject racism they faced both on and off the job. Stanley Grizzell's interviews tell us time and again about the bonds each one of his interviewees formed with fellow Porters and how those friendships remained strong throughout their lives. These men had nicknames for each other, which were often more inappropriate than not. Their friendly banter kept the environment in which they worked light, while reminding them of the lives they led outside the sleeping cars they serviced. The families and extended communities these men left behind for long stretches of time were never far from their minds. Porters also took great pride in reading their passengers. appearances and subsequent exchanges inspired more nicknames as well as fantastical stories. It was gossip about the good and the bad that got them through their long treks across the country. And it was this gossip about their difficult and extractive workspaces that connected them to one another, spreading ideas that created the conditions for transnational solidarity and ultimately unionization. Their stories demonstrate that they were, like all of us, human. And so it is important that we also shine a light on the ways these men made space for other exploits beyond the rails. They were so much greater than the abuse they suffered. Their lives were so much more than the hotel on wheels they served. Taking back power meant paving their own path through the choices they made in their time off. Some chose to leave portering early on in their careers. The demands of the job were just too much. For others willing to take risks, portering, as Dr. Sage Mathieu notes, served merely as a stepping stone to accomplishing the dreams these men had long shelved.
Portering and the different ways in which they supplemented their income from portering, which, again, sometimes people only want to hear the cute parts of the story, right? The sort of flattering parts of the story. But some sleeping car porters very much ran booze, were bootlegging, and wrote about it and bragged about how especially Montreal was wonderful for making that extra money. And that contributed to that mobility. It also contributed to their ability to sort of stick their thumb in the eye of the low wages and other forms of exploitation that they experienced while working on the rails.
While Montreal's Black community, situated within the city's Saint-Antoine district, has often been characterized by its impoverished conditions, this label does a disservice to the rich and vibrant culture that developed there. The Prohibition era, which ran from 1920 to 1933 in the United States, helped foster this growth. Given that Quebec was the last Canadian province to adopt similar legislation in 1918 and the first to repeal it a year later, Montreal's proximity to the American border made it attractive to many, especially those who bootlegged or moved booze between the two countries. Stories about how rum running and bootlegging worked in Montreal are notably absent from Standing Grizel's interview collection. But this one, told by Bill Overton, a 35-year veteran out of the CPR's Toronto Division, provides an important first-hand perspective on the railway's role in the unlawful but highly lucrative business ventures that led to the opening up of significant creative spaces for Black talent in the Saint-Antoine district and Montreal more generally.
I remember, too, some of the bootlegging days. There was a man in Windsor area who was, as a boy going along, he was a newsboy on the train. And then, of course, that's really a hustling position. And then when it come to liquor, he branched out and he became a bootlegger. He got quite a clientele of customers for his liquor, which he would buy in Montreal and ship through by train. There wasn't cars in the early days, I must remember. Trucks was very slow. The highways wasn't fit for trucks. But he would ship it through by train, the porters mostly, and sometimes dining car stewards would handle it for him. Everybody was paid off. But it got so some of the big time over there didn't like it. So they put a crimp in it and knocked him off several times. Well, then he got mad and he went over there and tried to hone in on the numbers racket in Detroit. And the word come out, there's a contract out on him. That is, there's somebody scheduled to kill him.
Is this a black man or a white man?
He was a white man. But here's the point. He came back and on the train, we knew him. He was one of our good customers. Good because he would always give us a dollar, always give us a pint of whiskey. Whether you drank it or not, it didn't matter. He left to go to England and never made it because they threw him overboard on the ocean. It was really known fact that it was because he was healthy going in, and of course the report went out he committed suicide. But they got him. He was trying to escape. But with him, why, he had control of the bootlegging up there, and of course many of our men going back and forth were bootlegging. There was a lot of boys made plenty of money bootlegging. And but I never made an awful lot. I never made an awful lot. I got maybe all told, $40-$50, because they were just giving me something to go look the other way, and that's all there was. I didn't get into it. I wasn't lucky. I couldn't feel myself lucky to do it. That's why I got nothing today, because some of them got plenty of money because they did.
From the 1920s through to the 1950s, the money made as a result of this illicit behavior helped to catapult Montreal to international repute as a wide-open city with a lively nightlife culture. But as Nancy Morelli points out in her book, Stepping Out, The Golden Age of Montreal Nightclubs, the racial geography of Montreal's club scene was one of complex race, class, and language relations, as well as territorial boundaries. The downtown clubs were on Saint-Antoine Street, where many blacks lived because it was close to the railways, where many of the men worked as porters. There was an active music scene in the black community, although there was a long history of discrimination in the unions until the early 1940s, and mixed black and white bands were not common. At various times, it was trendy to have black musicians and black shows, particularly in East End clubs, but all white policies were the rule in hotels and were common for uptown clubs in the early years. The downtown clubs usually had black musicians and entertainers, and their patron policies were wide open. That's where you could almost always find great music, and it was where other musicians went to jam after their shows in theaters or clubs in other parts of town. Some of the downtown clubs Morelli refers to included Rockhead's Paradise and Café Saint-Michel in the heart of Montreal's black community. Both clubs, which were owned by former porters, ensured that black musicians from not only Canada but elsewhere had safe stages on which to perform. Rumor has it that these proprietors had the capital needed to initiate these ventures because of the rum-running they did during the Prohibition era. Montreal soon offered a Canadian version of New York City's Harlem jazz scene, paving the way for great black Canadian talents, the likes of which included Oscar Peterson and Daisy Peterson Sweeney, Steep Wade, Oliver Jones, Joe Seeley, and Milton Seeley. Incidentally, all of these artists were the children of railway employees. Creating the conditions for a more just world for the next generation made the lived realities porters faced, as well as the risks they took, a little easier to tolerate. Those who embedded themselves in the era's criminal underworld and walked away unscathed were able to free themselves from the exploitative labor conditions they faced on the rails. That said, the vast majority of men did not participate in these risky ventures. The stakes were just too high, the costs too great. For most, unionization was the only way to improve working conditions, pay, and ultimately, porters' quality of life. As Leonard Oscar Johnston tells us, porters' elevated social status within their communities and the contributions they made to them led to the solidarity which made change possible.
Porters and their union have any status in the overall community?
Oh, yeah. Oh, sure, because at that time, the center of the community, were the elite of the community, were the porters. Because even during the Depression, it was the porters who were bringing home the food, you know? So they held a very important part in the community. They were not looked down on, you know.
What percentage of the households, black households, do you think were fed by porters' wages?
Oh, I'd say porters' wages fed about 90%.
Coming up in the fourth episode of Porter Talk, we'll explore porters' long fight to gain rights and respect on the job and how their collective efforts created the conditions for a unionized workforce.
I think one of the best lessons that can be learned from the presence of sleeping car porters all black men is that they can do it themselves. We organized the union without a government grant on our paltry income. We were able to do for ourselves, organize a union. So the lesson that the Porters can give to the community, and it's important that the history of Porters be documented, is that you have the ability, if you wish, to throw off the shackles of slavery and free yourself.
If you're interested in hearing more from Stanley Grizel and other Sleeping Car Porters, subscribe to Discover Library and Archives Canada. You'll receive episodes as they are released, which introduce you to these men as well as their wives and children. Together, they give voice to Black life on and off the rails during the 20th century. Leading Black scholars and historians help us contextualize Porter's experiences, enabling us to understand the myriad ways these citizens faced obstacles and persisted nevertheless.
All aboard!
Thank you for being with us. I'm Richard Provencher, your host. You've been listening to Porter Talk, the first season of Voices Revealed. Special thanks to our guests, Dr. Sage Mathieu and Cheryl Fogo. You can find biographies of each person who participated in this episode in the show notes. There, you will also find an episode transcript with embedded timestamps that link you to the original interview content in the Grizel collection. Feel free to explore and share these stories widely. We also acknowledge those who have done French voiceovers for this episode. Rodson Dieudonné, Gérard Hubert-Étienne, Bidi Coco Alfred, Lernce Joseph, Euphrasie Mujawamungu, Frédéric Pierre, and Christelle Chaco Womasom. Acclaimed musician and producer Paul Novotny composed Jazz Dance, the theme song for Porter Talk. Joe Seeley, famed jazz pianist who is the son of a porter, is also featured on the recording. All other music in this episode is from the audio library at blue.sessions.com. This episode was produced, written, engineered, and edited by Tom Thompson, Jennifer Woodley, and Stacey Zambricki. If you're interested in listening to the French equivalent of our podcast episodes, you can find them on our website or your favorite podcast app. Simply search for Découvrez Bibliothèque et Archives Canada. For more information on our podcasts, go to Library and Archives Canada's homepage, type podcast in the search bar in the top right corner, and click on the first link. If you have questions, comments, or suggestions, reach out to the podcast team at the email address located at the bottom of the episode page. Thank you.